Thank you, Patrick, and happy Sabbath, everybody. Good afternoon. It's good to see everybody again after kind of an exciting week this past week. Very exciting for those people in the Northeast. I don't know how many of you noticed the weather, but it's been pretty severe, and I hope you are remembering those members of our congregations in the Northeast. Boston got the heaviest snowfall it's had in something like 30 years, over 12 inches of snow in Boston. When we lived there, we got like 8 inches, and it stopped traffic for about 3 days. So I don't know what this is going to do for them, so I'm sure they would appreciate your prayers. Services have been canceled all around the Northeast and the North. In fact, I want to say hello to some folks who will probably be tuning in or have tuned in with us this morning from Minneapolis. I got an email this morning. Happy Sabbath to you guys in Minneapolis. And, of course, to Fred in Hawaii. We all wish we had Fred's weather, right? but we want to welcome everybody. Perhaps the Waugamas have tuned in, too. I know there's a lot of flu going around and illness, and the Waugamas are under the weather, as several of the others of our congregation are. But it's that time of the year. Please take care of your health as much as you can. We know there's a lot of illness floating around out there. But we're glad to have everybody joining us today online and here in person for our services here in Portland. We had a bit of a crisis this morning. we have a precocious cat named Sinatra, and he disappeared this morning. And he's been in our family for, as near as we can tell, about 15 or 16 years. And that was one of the hardest decisions I ever had to make, is when I asked my wife to marry me, and she said, well, yeah, I guess I will, but it comes with a 16-year-old daughter and a, I think it was at that time, about a 5-year-old cat. And like I said, that was the hardest hump I had to jump over. I wasn't really a cat lover until Sinatra came into my life via Linda. And since then, we have kind of gotten attached to each other. But we've got some construction going on in our house. We're remodeling our kitchen, and those vents, you know, to the heater system were open because, and the last time Linda had some work done on a house down in the Bay Area, the vents were open and the cat wandered into the vent system, and she had to just about tear the walls apart to get him out. So this morning there was a little bit of a panic. We couldn't find him anywhere, his usual sleeping places. He wasn't there. We didn't know where he was. And Linda thought, he's in the vent system, you know, like before, something like 10, 12 years ago. So we're going to have to tear the place apart to get the cat, you know, out of the heating system. The amazing thing is, when you call cats, they don't come like dogs. This was one of the reasons I didn't like cats, you know. You go around the house, you can call, you can call, you can call. And we finally found him inside of a linen closet where he'd never slept before that we know of, crawled up on the second shelf, and he was sleeping on some blankets in the linen closet. And we opened the door, and finally we were looking through all, you know, this is the last place we'd probably look. We'd search the house 2 or 3 times over, usual places, and we found him comfortably sleeping on a blanket. And he looks up like, yes, what do you want? Anyway, we found the cat, so the crisis was over. Linda could sigh of relief, and we could come to church. She wouldn't have to stay home tearing apart the heating vent system to try and recover the cat. May all crises be that minor, right? You know, Patrick was commenting about his beautiful suit. I suspect it's not just the tailor, but it might be the chili. For those of you who aren't aware of it, Patrick makes very good chili. In fact, he won our chili cook-off last Saturday night with his chili. And I'll tell you, he puts filet mignon there, bourbon, beer. Oh, yeah, I guess there were some beans in there, too, but there was a lot of fattening things in his chili, and I think that's why he won. But congratulations to Patrick for winning the chili cook-off last Saturday night, and lay off the chili in your suit might fit you better. I know that was a problem. It's a fairly new suit, and he just had it tailored, but Looks nice on you, by the way. Anyway, we're glad to be back. It was, like I said, a busy week. I certainly want to thank once again the Yosts who coordinated the activities that we had last week over the winter weekend. And I want to thank others like Sharon and Michelle and Linda and many others of you who contributed to the meals and brought lots of things. I know it was a pretty stressful week all in all, but I think because we had so many people contributing, it really made the workload fairly light. So thank you again to everybody who made contributions for the weekend. I considered it to be very successful. Wish we could have had more people, but you know, sometimes you realize that winter weekends are busy times, only time off from school for a lot of people or work, but it was a successful weekend. We do have a thank you card for Dr. Levy on the table in the hall. And even if you weren't able to attend all events, if you'd like to sign that card for Dr. Levy, I would appreciate it. So please take the time after services today to go by and write your thank yous to Dr. Levy on that card. And we're going to be sending him a package on Monday. So I'd like to include that card. So please make sure you sign that today. I do have a prayer request that many of you may have noticed in the update. Marion Long, and I hope the Longs are joining us today, from Spokane, request your prayers. Marion has a small tumor on the optical nerve of her right eye, and the neurosurgeon is recommending laser surgery to correct the problem. And anytime you have surgery on the optical nerve, there's always a risk of losing your eyesight. And of course, we don't want that for Marion, and she certainly doesn't want it. So she would appreciate your prayers for God's healing of this tumor, and of course that God would guide her in the decision regarding the surgery. And then if she does decide to do it, that God would certainly guide the surgeon in removing that tumor. So please be remembering Marion Long in your prayers as well. The latest monthly member letter from Mr. Franks was included in the update. I hope you had a chance to read that. Mr. Franks talked a great deal about the Louisville weekend and the activities that were there. There were nearly 1,000 people gathered down in Louisville for the weekend that just passed. And I understand a lot of very positive comments and wonderful activities were experienced there. Also, the update from Mr. Franks concerned a lot of that, and he gave us honorable mention, and he included a couple of pictures, I think, that Jeff took of us in his update. If you haven't already seen that, you might want to do that. You might be pictured in one of those pictures sleeping during the seminar. No, you wouldn't. I don't think anybody was sleeping during Dr. Levy's seminars. He's a very interesting and captivating teacher. We will be having potluck after services today. You're all welcome to stick around. I think we have plenty of food available for everybody, so hopefully everybody will stay for that and fellowship. Also, the leadership club will take place after the potluck, so hopefully the conference room is available to us and we can meet over there. So we'll plan to meet over there after our potluck today. And then one final announcement. This is regarding the Young Adult Leadership Weekend that will take place over the President's Weekend, February 14th through the 16th. If you would like to attend, we would be happy to have you join us. One of the 7 locations that has been selected for this simultaneous conference has been Portland, Oregon. And since we've got it here in our backyard, of course, I hope many of you will take advantage to come. And like I said, even if you're not technically a young adult, which we usually say is 30-something and younger, you're welcome to attend with us. This year's theme will be Salt of the Earth, Christian Leadership by Example. During the weekend, we'll cover such topics as how example is the foundation of leadership, how to put God and the church first in our busy lives, how to deal with lust while living amid a provocative culture, and what it means to be pure before God. Keynote speakers for the weekend will be Mr. Franks, Mr. Horchak, Mr. Kylo, and others Their presentations will be streamed over the internet to the other locations where they will not be present physically, so everyone will be able to benefit from each presentation. So that's coming up, like I said, in February, and hopefully many of you will want to attend. We need you to register to show your desire to attend. You may go online at the Members Cogwa website and register at members.cogwa.org/YALW, Young Adult Leadership Weekend, YALW. We have acronyms for everything in the church, and we want you to go there and register for the YALW coming up on President's Weekend. If you've read a newspaper, a news magazine, turned on the radio or television, you will know that nearly everyone is talking about 2014. The new year according to the Gregorian calendar. People are reminiscing about what happened in 2013, the top stories of the year. And of course, they're speculating about what will happen in 2014. What will happen in 2014? Should we even care what will happen? Are we interested in the future? Well, of course, we're interested in the future. Our hope, our reason for being here is the return of Jesus Christ and the resurrection to glory. They're front and center in our minds, aren't they? What should we be looking for in 2014? Are there trends or specific events we should look for and anticipate this coming year? Let's begin by going to 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy chapter 3, I'd like to begin reading here in verse 1. 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 through 5. Paul was writing this letter to young Timothy about the culture in which he lived, and certainly the culture and the times in which we live are even more perilous and more serious than what Paul had to address. But in verse 1 of 2 Timothy 3, Paul wrote, "But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come." The word perilous means dangerous, scary, risky, in many ways. "But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come." Again, he was writing this to Timothy, but the days in which we live are even more precarious, as I mentioned earlier. "For men will be lovers of themselves." Again, it's nothing new for people to be selfish, people to mainly be self-centered and focused on self. That's nothing new. It's been extant with humans and human nature since the first human beings. But the way that Paul writes about it here, it seems like it grows exponentially towards the end times, towards the last days. That selfishness and self-centeredness becomes a focus of our culture in the last days. Lovers of money. Boasters. Proud. Blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy. I don't know, as I've read through this list yesterday and this morning as I was going over my sermon notes again, I thought, you know, many of us can probably think of immediate examples of the culture around us, whether we're talking about entertainment or whether we're talking about people we may know, or whether we're just talking about the culture at large. We see these descriptors being played out before us day in and day out. Sometimes as we read them, we probably have pangs of guilt, or at least the conscience is knocking in the back of our heads, reminding us that, yes, we too have fallen prey to these influences. Verse 3, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. But this is the key. Our culture seems to be earmarked by a desire for a higher level of experience in the carnality field or area. Lovers of pleasure. You know, we want to go to be entertained by something that is more sensual all the time, right? It's kind of interesting. When we were in Hawaii, we were walking through a shopping mall, and there was a member there who said, "Hey, would you like to join me in a new experience?" And I said, "What is this?" And it was called 4D. Maybe some of you have been in some of these little theaters that are, it's beyond 3D, it's 4D. And you go in to be entertained into these little theaters, and you sit in the chairs, and the video draws you in because the seat moves, you know, in the direction you're either riding or flying or driving. And there's actually little jets of air that blow on you when there's like a spider web blowing by in the movie, and the little jet of air blows on you. It's 4D. They want you to actually experience not just visually what's happening on the screen, but there's, like I said, the seat moves around and jumps and jolts, and you actually are in a 4D movie experience. And now they're talking about, in the future, technology is going to bring us holograms, you know, where you can actually be in a room with people and they're going to be all around you. And, the human mind creates all these wonderful things where you want to experience more and more and more. It's no longer good enough to sit down and read a book and let your imagination work, right? We have to be stimulated, you know, to the highest degree. We go to a movie where there's a big screen and loud music, and we can kind of feel the emotion of the entertainment. Now, again, I'm not down on entertainment. I thought it was kind of an interesting experience. I didn't have to pay for it. This man was very generous and said, "Oh, look, I'll pay for the whole group." And there were about 15 or 20 of us walking in a group together. We were watching a show that was happening in the plaza. And he said, "Come on in. I'll invite you to come in and watch this show." I wouldn't have spent the money to watch a 4D presentation, but it was kind of interesting. Like I said, and I'm not down on it particularly. I'm just saying that this is the way human nature is. We want to experience more. We want to titillate our senses to the highest degree that technology will allow. But if we do that to the exclusion of God, then it becomes a problem. Lovers of pleasure, as it says in verse 4, rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power. And I want to talk specifically about what that means for our nation and our church as I get into this sermon today. Having a form of godliness but denying the power of God, and from such people turn away. God warns us that there's the potential of a problem of being drawn into a world that sets carnal pleasures and experiences above seeking God and His way. I realize it's very challenging in this culture in which we live to keep ourselves from being sucked into the trends, the fads, the attitudes of the world around us. Very challenging. That's why Christ and the apostles provide so many warnings for us, especially, like Paul said, in the last days. Let's go back and read the words of Christ in Matthew 24. Matthew 24, verses 1 through 8. I'd like to read Christ's words here, Matthew 24. In verse 1, we find that Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple, which at this point were relatively new. Herod the Great had spent a great deal of time, energy, and money building, or rebuilding, as he put it, Solomon's temple. It didn't have the riches that Solomon's temple had, but it had a splendor. It was bigger. It was greater. And, of course, if you've ever been to Jerusalem, you can go to the, I guess it would be the southwestern corner of the Temple Mount, and you can actually touch and see the size of the stones that were laid as the foundation for this construction project. And these stones are about the size of half of a school bus. They're huge stones. And these stones were stacked in interlocking fashion, one upon another, to build the platform of the temple that Solomon had constructed, Herod had constructed. And, of course, this was a big engineering and construction marvel of the time. And the disciples, you know, who were fishermen, countrymen from Galilee, and they came to Jerusalem two or three times a year during the holy day seasons, and they wanted to see this great marvel. And they wanted to show it to Christ again and marvel at this construction project. And Jesus said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Even this great, marvelous construction, this huge temple, this building mount? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." I can't imagine what was going through the disciples' minds as they were walking with the rabbi, and they were walking in the shadow of this great wall and these huge stones. What were they thinking? You know, this, it took 46 years to build this. And you are telling us that these stones are going to be thrown down? How can that be? It was almost an incredulous statement. This is the way he began. "Do you not know these things?" I think we should ask ourselves, when we see trends around us, we see cultures that we think are indestructible, like the United States of America, a world power. And we can ask ourselves the question that Christ asked his disciples, "Do you not see all these things?" There are things to be seen in 2014, things we should look for. Things I think we should be mindful of. Let's continue on. "Now, as he said on the Mount of Olives," and the Mount of Olives had just crossed the Jezreel Valley from the Temple Mount, and from that vantage point, you can look down on the temple. It's pretty dramatic. In fact, just about every tour that I've been on in Jerusalem, tour guides will first take you up to the top of Mount of Olives, and you will look down on the Temple Mount, and it's fabulous. Even today, which is not in the same extent or glory that Herod had, certainly that Solomon had in his day. And as they were sitting there looking down on the temple, they said to him, "Tell us, when will these things be?" They clearly knew he was talking about prophecy and the future and what's going to happen. He says to them, in answer to their question, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" And Jesus answered and told them, "Take heed that no one deceives you." In answering the question about prophecy, the first warning was, be careful spiritually. Take heed spiritually. "For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am from Christ,' or 'I am even the Christ,' and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars." It's rather interesting if you go online and you just type in current wars, and Wikipedia pops up right away. And there are currently, as of this morning, I looked it up, there are currently 11 major wars or conflicts going on in the world today. As we sit here, 11. Now, you might want to know, well, what makes a major conflict or war? It's where 1,000 people have died in a year as a result a political or military conflict. And right now there are 11 of these going on right now. There have been more or less throughout the ages, but right now there are considered to be major wars in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Nigeria, Syria, Central Africa, the Central African Republic, the Sudan. And among these 11, interestingly enough, it said the Mexican drug war, which has claimed in the past year 111,000 lives. I didn't know that. I was a little struck that that was included in the 11, the Mexican drug war. 111,000 people have died in the last year because of that conflict. And then they had an additional list. Like I said, you can go home and look this up on Wikipedia. 32 lesser wars are currently going on. This involves less than 1,000 casualties this past year, but still are political conflicts of one kind or another. So 11 major wars and 32 lesser wars are taking place even as we sit here today in this world. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars. And of course, those began with the Romans in Christ's day all the way down to today. See that you are not troubled. We know these have always been with us and conflicts come and go. See that you not be troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and we see that as a fallout of many of these wars, like Syria, where now they're saying almost 2 million people have been displaced and live in refugee camps. And of course, the children are the most affected, who are suffering from pestilences like lice and other diseases that result in living in close quarters with other people with insufficient hygiene, water, and toilets. There will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these, in verse 8, are the beginning of sorrows. Again, this coming year, 2014, we will see a continuation of conflicts among nations. The peace that Woodrow Wilson in founding the United Nations will not be discovered this year, in 2014. It won't come. We will see more conflicts. We will see many of these conflicts that I just mentioned escalate, and more lives will be lost, more innocent people, more soldiers will be maimed, disabled as a result of these wars. It's going to happen. It's just the nature of the world around us. How do we as Christians, how should we react to such trends that will, these geopolitical trends that will take place? For us who live in the relative comfort of the United States of America, sometimes we can just shut these off mentally and emotionally by turning off the television set, turning down the radio, unsubscribing to the newspaper. It's easy to push these things off, isn't it? We recognize academically, okay, there's a lot of people in torment out there. But how should we as Christians react? Let's go back to Ezekiel. Ezekiel chapter 9. I'd like to read here what the angel revealed to the prophet Ezekiel about such things that went on in ancient Israel. And I think we should consider this as a lesson for our reaction to such things in thinking about how we will cope with the coming year and what we will hear about and what we will see, what we will know is going on in maybe not our backyard, but around us in this world. As technology expands, the world gets smaller and smaller. I think we know that. We now have the 24/7 news cycle. We have, like I said, modern technology that binds us together. It still amazes me that, you know, I can get on Skype and I can talk to somebody in Australia or Jordan and do a Bible study. And for them, it's nighttime, but for me, it's early in the morning. It's just a marvel. The world is small. We couldn't do that 20 years ago. So everything that happens in the world affects us. Look in Ezekiel chapter 9 and verse 3. Now the glory of the God of Israel had gone up from the cherub, where it had been, to the threshold of the temple. And he called to the man clothed with linen, who had the writer's inkhorn at his side. And the Lord said to him, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem. And as we know in the prophecies of Ezekiel and Jeremiah and Isaiah, that Jerusalem is also always or often synonymous with Israel, not just the city, but is another way of addressing the entire nation of Israel. And in our case, the descendants of the ancient Israelites, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and cry over all the abominations that are done within it. And again, I think we can be challenged by what goes on around us by how do we react to it? Do we just shut it out? Do we, like so many other people, dull our minds to these things that go on in the world around us? In verse 5, and to the others he said in my hearing, go after him through the city and kill. Do not let your eye spare nor have pity. Utterly slay old and young, men, maidens, little children, and women. But do not come near anyone on whom is the mark. And begin at my sanctuary. Begin with my people. We know that God's people are the temple of God, the sanctuary, if you will. God wants to know how we respond to the abominations that go on in our world. How do we feel about it? There's nothing we can really do about it other than pray for thy kingdom come. But we can sigh and cry and bemoan the suffering that goes on in this world as a result of wars, as Christ said. It will increase, but I think the test for us as God's people is how will we react to it? Will we just push it away? Will we just turn it off? Or will we indeed be driven to our knees to ask God's intervention, to ask God to send his kingdom to solve these problems, because human beings cannot solve their own problems? I think this is really brought out in something that maybe is closer to home that I could talk about, and that is money. Again, I Googled those nations with the greatest national debt. You want to guess who they are? The top 10 with the greatest national debts? Maybe in your own mind you can think about who in this world has the greatest national debt that they financed their economy, finance wars, finance whatever the government engages in. The number one debtor nation in the world. Well, maybe I should start with 10 and go to number one. Number 10, with a national debt of $2,290 billion, roughly, is Spain. Spread out at its population, that's a per capita debt of $18,260 per person, man, woman, and children. Number 9, Italy. Number 8, Luxembourg. Number 7, the Netherlands. Number 6, China. It's kind of interesting. China's national debt, though, is only $396 per citizen in China. The lowest per capita national debt. Number 5 is Japan. Number 4 is France. Number 3, Germany. Number 2, the United Kingdom. Their debt is a little over $10 trillion. $1,000. That works out to $160,000 per every man, woman, and child that lives in the British Isles. Number one, the biggest debtor nation in the world, the United States of America, with a national debt that now exceeds $17.3 trillion. A number that's unfathomable. The outstanding public debt as of January the 4th is $17,319,530,181,196.91. Whew! The estimated population of the United States as of this morning was around 317 million people. So each citizen's share of this debt is about $54,500 per man, woman, and child in the United States of America. $54,000. Now you, again, might be thinking, well, this is a figure that I can't do anything about or control, so I'm just going to put it aside and push it aside, not think about it. But it does, and it will affect us. If we think of our nation as a family, what happens to a nation that goes deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper into debt? Bankruptcy, I heard somebody say. That's right. Eventually, someday, this great nation, just like those walls of ancient Jerusalem, will come tumbling down. I remember in 2005, when Linda and I were looking for a house in San Diego, it was right at the crest of the housing market. And the housing market had been going up 20% a year, and everybody was buying and selling houses like crazy in Southern California. It looked like it wasn't going to end, this great gold rush. And I still remember that there were, we walked into this condominium complex, and there were literally real estate agents and owners standing side by side saying, "Won't you buy my condominium? Won't you buy my condo?" There were three or four real estate agents on a Sunday afternoon standing outside with open houses out of this condominium complex. "Come on in and buy my place." 3 years later, of course, those condos, the bottom fell out of the market in Southern California, and those condos dropped in value 50, 60%. We've seen it happen. We know what happens in an exaggerated market like Southern California, Las Vegas, Phoenix, you know those markets that all took a big tumble in 2008, 2009? It's going to happen again. It's just a matter of what time. How long? The national debt currently continues to increase at a rate of $2.72 billion a day. In this country. It's hard to wrap our minds around this. Every day our national debt grows by $2.72 billion. The world's economy cannot sustain that. There is a day of reckoning coming financially. I'm not suggesting that, you know, you sell your house now and put your money in a coffee can and stick it under your mattress. I'm not suggesting that. What I am suggesting is there are some personal things we can do that maybe we should think about this coming year in order to cope with the future. Number one is get out of debt. I remember years ago, Mr. Armstrong encouraged all of us to do this. For those of you who are old enough to be around, what did he say? Get out of debt, live a simpler lifestyle. Our objective should be to get out of debt. Really have nothing more than maybe your automobile and your home over your head as a liability. Definitely get out of credit debt. Live within your budget. Save. Save your money. Tough and rocky financial times are ahead. So what can we do as individuals, as Christians, responsible Christians in this culture? As Christ said, don't be surprised. It's coming. Get prepared. Try to get out of debt. Set some goals for you and your family, for all of us to get out of debt. Live within our budgets. Save, 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 save for hard times. They're coming. As we're thinking about this world around us, I'd like to shift into a spiritual vein. Things that we might look for, trends that we've been warned of. I don't know how many of you have noticed. I think a lot of you have. I've had conversations with several of you about the current Pope. He's only been 9 months in his job, and yet he's one of the most popular popes who've ever lived, as far as we know, at least in modern times. I'd like to share with you an article that I read. This was from December 24th, CNN. It says a recent CNN ORC international poll released Tuesday, that was the 24th, found that 88% of American Catholics strongly approve of how Francis is handling his role as head of 1.2 billion Catholics. The popular pontiff has also made a very positive impression among Americans in general. And of course, many Catholics around the world think American Catholics have basically gone to hell, you know, just because of our view of abortion and contraception and some other ideas that the Catholic, strict Catholics, conservative Catholics, particularly South American or African Catholics, just they do not accept the American church. They think we're very liberal, or they think the Catholic Church is very liberal in America. 9 months into his papacy, the Argentinian-born Francis has captured attention with crowd-pleasing acts of compassion, from embracing a severely disfigured man to washing the feet of juvenile delinquents, to hosting homeless men at his birthday mass this month. The Pope has also shown a common touch rare for such a lofty religious leader. He has eschewed the trappings of the papacy in favor of humbler digs, simpler vestments, and a cheaper car. He worked as a bar bouncer and janitor before he became a priest, and he's not shy about telling people about his humble roots. This has touched a chord with people. People of the world want a miracle worker. I think he's a very interesting personality to come on the scene. I'm not suggesting that he's the one, you know, the one that may become the false prophet prophesied. But I'll tell you, he's one of the most likely candidates that I've seen in a long time, many decades. He's very compassionate. He could easily fit the role. He's very charismatic. As I just read from the article, he's very popular. We need to watch. How would you react if somebody like Pope Francis resurrected somebody from the dead? Healed people by the hundreds. How would that affect you and me? Would we be deceived? Why? Just because he's Catholic? Think about it. It's a trend I think we need to watch. Let's go to 1 Timothy chapter 3. 1 Timothy chapter 3, where we were earlier. This time I'd like to read verse 13, 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 13. But evil men, even though they may not look so evil, and imposters will grow worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. Like I said, this is something I think we need to be aware of, thoughtful about when it comes to religion, when it comes to spirituality. The Weymouth New Testament reads this way on 2 Timothy would be chapter 3, verse 13. The Weymouth translation says, bad men and imposters will go on from bad to worse, misleading and being misled. I recently read a Pew Forum research survey. It talked about religion in America, which I found very interesting. I'd like to share the results of that survey with you. Show you what trends are happening within the United States of America, not just the world as a whole and Catholicism, but what's happening in our country. This is from December 2013, the Pew Forum Research Survey. More than one quarter of American adults, that is 28%, have left the faith in which they were raised in favor of another religion or no religion at all. If change in affiliation from one type of Protestantism to another is included, 44% of adults have either switched religious affiliation, moved from being unaffiliated with any religion to being affiliated with a particular faith, or dropped any connection to religion altogether. So almost 50% have moved around. This is a trend in our culture, is religious movement. Moving from one Protestant organization to another, moving from Catholicism to Protestantism, moving from church to church. Sound familiar? Kind of scary, isn't it? The trends of this world affect the church, don't they? They affect us. The survey also finds that the number of people who say that they are unaffiliated with any particular faith today, that is 16.1%, is more than double the number it was 10 years ago. So the trend is to become unaffiliated with any particular organization or faith. That's the trend. To move away, to either become unchurched or to build their own faith. As this survey goes on, it says, among Americans aged 18 to 29, 1 in 4, that is 25%, say they are not currently affiliated with any particular religion. And those who are prefer the smorgasbord religion. I'll have one of these and one of those and one of that. And they build their own religion, their own consciousness with God, which is the fad with most, a majority of 18 to 29-year-olds, even when they consider themselves religious. The survey confirms that the United States is on the verge of becoming a minority Protestant country. The number of Americans who report that they are members of Protestant denominations now stands at barely 51%. It was 78% 20 years ago. Do we see the trend? The trend is interesting because in Europe today, it's only 7% of the population considers themselves affiliated with a religious organization. The United States of America is following this trend. It says, moreover, the Protestant population is characterized by significant internal diversity and fragmentation. Listen to that again. The Protestant population is characterized by significant internal diversity and fragmentation. People are believing different things. They're creating this hodgepodge of personal religion, and they're fragmenting. Sound familiar? Scary. The survey finds that constant movement characterizes the American religious marketplace, as every major religious group is simultaneously gaining and losing adherents. Adherents, as he says here, churchgoers are moving between organizations. Back and forth, back and forth. Sound familiar? Like I said, the trends in the world are sometimes played out in the world. The biggest gainer in this religious competition and movement is the unaffiliated group, particularly among the young, where they're satisfied to go here, go there, not become affiliated with any particular organization. And I believe oftentimes that trend translates into a very similar trend in God's church. where we see a lack of commitment. Oftentimes, in God's church. Let's go to Matthew 24. Back to Matthew 24. In verse 12. Matthew 24. Verses 12 and 13. Christ continues on in his discussion with the disciples. And he says, and because lawlessness will abound, that is, the law that he's talking about is the law of God, because lawlessness, the breaking of God's law, will abound, the love of many will grow cold. Another word for love growing cold, the word here in the Greek is agape, it's a general love, is apathy. Which, of course, marks this kind of uncommitted group of people that we read about in the Pew Research survey. Because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. What Christ is indicating here is that this trend continues and intensifies right up until the time of the end. I think the pulpit commentary has a very interesting comment on verse 12. It says, because iniquity shall abound, that is, be multiplied, it will grow exponentially. The word rendered iniquity is lawlessness, that is, general immorality and license, laxity, impatience of rule and discipline, connivance at the imitation of heathen practices, reacted upon the faith of believers, undermines steadfast adherence to principle. It undermines steadfast adherence to principle. In other words, everybody basically does what's right in his or her own eyes. Then the love of many shall wax cold. Love here is the agape. Here it is used in its general and comprehensive sense as having, first of all, God as its chief object and man in subordination thereto. So what Christ is describing here, it says the love of many will grow cold. He's primarily talking about the love that people have for God. Not each other primarily, but for God. The love of many will grow cold. And of course, the less love we have for God, the less love we have for fellow human beings. It goes hand in hand. How does love for God look? Isn't it unseen? Prayer, Bible study, fasting, meditation, aren't these disciplines that are practiced behind closed doors? Largely not seen by others? Or does the expression of love, love for God, have a face? Is it seen? Do we know what it is? If the fruit of it can be seen, what does it look like? I'd like to go to Romans 13 as a follow-up to what Christ said. Romans chapter 13. In verse 10, Romans 13, 10. Paul admonishes the church at Rome, who probably lived in one of the worst microcultures on earth and in history. Ancient Rome during the first century. Debauchery at its highest. Death and war were extolled. Great generals were made the next Caesar. He wrote to them, he says in verse 10, I'm breaking in the middle of this thought, I'll let you read the entire chapter at your own pace, but he says, love does no harm to a neighbor. We know that, don't we? Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. Loving God, and then following that standard, that principle, does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love fulfills the law of God. I think we all know that academically. And do this, in verse 11, knowing the time, and now it is high time to awake out of sleep. For now our salvation is nearer than when we first believed. The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Therefore, let us cast off the works of darkness, and let us put on the armor of light. What do we call this? Like I said, what's the face of it? What does it look like? Is it just a private relationship, as a lot of people are beginning to think today in the trends in religion? It's just me and God, and I'll kind of pick and choose how and when I want to serve God, and my dedication to an organization or a group, it's not really that important. I have a handout for us to consider today. Gentlemen, would you please hand that out? It is an assessment tool for knowledge, understanding, and zeal that I'd like to share with all of you today as we're contemplating 2014 and what we will be doing over the next 12 months, what we shall be thinking about. Let's begin by assessing where we are today. While you're considering that handout, it's coming around, let's go to Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians 4 and verse 11. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 11. This describes why the church is organized and why it needs to be organized and the goal, the purpose of the organized church. Verse 11, and he himself gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers for the equipping of the saints for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, to build up the body of Christ, not break it down and further scatter it. And unfortunately, it looks like another COG community is going to be breaking up again. Sadly. Makes you wonder, when is it going to stop? When is the trend going to be bucked? And I think the most important aspect we can look at when we're thinking about trends for 2014 is the spiritual trend. And let's focus it on our personal sense of godliness. Continue reading in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 13. Let's go back to verse 12. For the equipping of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, that is a mature man, to the measure and the stature and the fullness of Christ, that we should no longer be children tossed to and fro and carried about by every wind of doctrine, which again is the trend in religion in the world. I just read you from that survey. By the trickery of men and the cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting, but speaking the truth in love, may grow up in all things unto him who is the head, that is Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective working by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. What is this describing here in Ephesians? It's describing what we call in one word zeal. Zeal. How zealous are we? The opposite of zeal is apathy. How zealous are we? How zealous are we going to be for the year to come? I think it's an important consideration that we need to make. Let's go back to the assessment that I've handed out to all of you. What I've done is I've taken the elements mentioned in Ephesians 4 and applied them to this little survey. It's a self-survey. I'm not going to collect it. Don't put your name on it. This is private to you. It's for your edification and admonition. just like it is for me. I've broken it down into three categories. One is understanding God, two is personal spiritual maturity, and three is relationships within the body. I can't claim credit for this. This little survey, if some of you may recognize it, comes from Mr. Kylo. When he became president of the church back in 2005, he sent the ministers all this little survey. Understanding God. Do we have a good grasp of the knowledge of God that is biblical knowledge? Again, the assessment criteria is, go ahead and rate where you think you fall in this criteria. Doctrinal stability. Where do we feel we fall in doctrinal stability? Is our doctrinal house stable? Or is it a house of cards? It can be blown over by every wind of doctrine, which Paul so descriptively put it. Are we unified in the faith? Is our faith unifying? Does it bring us together? Or are we consumed with apathy and, you know, we get up on a Sabbath morning and we go, you know, I think I'll just stay home today. Or I think I'll go on a camping trip. Or I think I'll do this or that. There's nothing wrong with camping trips occasionally on the Sabbath. I'm not suggesting that's a wrong thing. I'm just saying, what is the motivation? Are we part of the church? And why are we part of the church? What will the church look like, I have to ask myself as the pastor, in 2014? Will we be described this way? I don't think every one of us will be able to put fives on every one of these descriptors. I wish we would. I wish we could. I didn't give myself fives, to be perfectly honest about it, because I think there's always room for growth. Number two, personal spiritual maturity. Are we attaining to a mature man or woman? Are we no longer children that is spiritually immature? Are we attaining the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ? And if you put a five down here, I want to talk to you afterwards, because I want to enjoy the glow of the warmth that's coming from you. We all know we have, I jest, room to grow, don't we? Number three, relationships within the body. Are we working effectively together? Are we speaking the truth to each other, but in love? Are we doing our part? Are we involved? Are we carrying our end of the box? Are we causing growth to the body? That's the challenge that Paul gave in Ephesians 4. Are we causing growth? Are we pulling away? Are we edifying one another in love, encouraging one another, admonishing each other when we have discussions, when we talk? What do we talk about? What lousy husbands we have, what terrible marriages we have, what a lousy church we're in. You know, what do we talk about? Things that are edifying? I think we have plenty of challenges to look forward to in this world in which we live over 2014. I would like us as a congregation to be filled with zeal and to work towards making all of these personal assessments fives over the next 12 months. We live in a very dangerous world and very dangerous times, as Paul told us. Christ said the times of the end would be very challenging. And if it were not for God's Spirit, even the very elect would be deceived. Let's not take our Christianity for granted. Let's become zealous, like Christ was zealous. I'd like to conclude by going to John chapter 2, John 2, and reading a scripture John 2 and verse 13. It says, "Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And he found in the temple those who sold oxen and sheep and doves, and the money changers doing business. And when he had made a whip of cords, he drove them out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen, and he poured out the changers' money and overturned the tables. And he said to those who sold doves, 'Take these things away. Do not make my Father's house a house of merchandise.'" Let's not make our Father's house a house of apathy. God has given us His Spirit. He expects more of that, the fruit of that Spirit from us. Verse 17, "Then His disciples remembered that it was written, 'Zeal for your house has eaten me up.'" It's quite a statement. It's a quote from Psalm 69, verse 9. "Zeal for your house has eaten me up." Of all things that we consider and do in 2014, I think we need to ask ourselves the question, do we have zeal for the house of God?